The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
It could be described as probably one of the most intense periods of time in the Jewish calendar. I guess you could say that there is the traditional intense period of time, which is Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the Aseres Mitzvah, you know, that whole sort of intense week and a half. This is of a different nature. You come out of Pesach, and you basically waltz smack into Yom HaShoah, which is Holocaust Memorial Day. This, it actually should be this Thursday, but it's pushed up to Wednesday because in Israel they push it up earlier so that there won't be any issues with Shabbat. Wednesday is Israel's Memorial Day, which is a fundamentally different day than Memorial Days in America, at least from my experience. And then, of course, Thursday is Yom HaTzimut. This year is Israel's 60th anniversary, and the state of Israel, that is. And it's a very intense period of time. And I don't think that it's accidental that this week always falls around these two portions, in between Kedoshim, which we just had, and Emor, which is the parsha coming up, right? Kedoshim to you is an injunction which is somewhat ambiguous. It's not at all clear what the Torah wants. If you look up, for example, in the Sefer HaChinuch, in the Book of Knowledge, which is a medieval work that was written by an unknown Torah sage for his son's bar mitzvah, literally, at various points in the book, he addresses his son and his friends, and I've been studying it this year with my daughter for her bat mitzvah, and it's an incredible way to go through all of the mitzvot in the Torah, at least from one perspective. So when you get to the portion of Vayikra and Parshat Kedoshim, he doesn't list Kedoshim to you as a mitzvah, right? On the other hand, the Ramban, Nachmanides, is very clear about this mitzvah, and he actually has a disagreement with Rashi as to what the nature of this mitzvah is, okay? And that forms an interesting question. What is the mitzvah of sanctity? You know, what does it mean, Kedoshim to you, to be holy? Okay? In this week's portion, Emor, which is the follow-up to Kedoshim, the portion starts, this portion really is very much about the Kohanim, right? Vayomer Hashem Moshe Emor el HaKohanim Bnei Aaron. This portion is supposedly given to the Kohanim, to the priests, which should mean that it's not really for us, so why exactly is it included in the Torah? There are whole sections of Jewish tradition that were given down to Moshe at Sinai, at least according to our tradition, that aren't in the Torah. And according to the Talmud, the Kohanim, young Kohanim, would study in special schools for Kohanim for 5 years before they were ready to be introduced to service in the temple. So why is this portion here? So obviously Jewish tradition has it that there's a sub-theme to this portion, which is that we, the Jewish people, are a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. We're also a nation of priests, and we're supposed to be a holy nation. And therefore, all of these particular messages that are included in the Torah for the kohanim are really messages for us as well. So it's interesting, then, that this portion begins, right? Ve'amarta alehem lenefesh lo yitama be'amav, that a kohen is not supposed to become tamei. He's not supposed to become impure, which literally means he's not supposed to come into contact with a dead person, a dead body, or the results of death, except ki'im lish'ero akarov elav, except for imo, aviv, bno, bito, achiv, the seven relatives that are close enough to a person that if they, God forbid, pass away, that in fact this person would sit shiva, would have the traditional 7 days of mourning, that those circumstances not only would allow a Kohen to become Tameh, to become impure by contact with death, they would actually demand that the Kohen become impure. All of which raises a number, I'm sorry, you're hearing the dogs in the background here in the mountains of Ephrat, so just imagine you're sitting in Israel here. It raises an interesting question, why is that the follow-up to Kedoshim? Why is that seemingly the important injunction that needs to be given to the Kohanim in the portion that is specifically defined as God's word to the Kohanim. Right? This is the portion called Emor. Right? So, what is that about? And I guess all of this plays into sort of what Yom HaZikaron and maybe Yom HaTzmaut and certainly Yom HaShoah are all about. You know, remembering is not a simple thing. It brings with it a whole host of challenges. You know, I have a very short list of families that I try to call every year on the eve of Memorial Day, and that's a ritual that most Americans don't really have. And as much as you know, I could do without it. On the other hand, it's a powerful part of my year. You know, what do you say to call up a family who is so immersed in the loss of their son, and specifically on Yom HaZikaron, right? So I was once standing next to Cheryl Mandel a few years ago, before my cousin was killed in the Lebanon War. Since then, we've always been in Ra'anana. We were here in Gush Etzion. And I just didn't make it into Jerusalem that year, so I went to the memorial service at the cemetery here in Gush Etzion, where there are a number of soldiers buried. Part of the tradition of Memorial Day is that the units of the soldiers who have fallen send a soldier to stand by every grave of a soldier that fell from their unit. In other words, if you go to Har Herzl, right, and you walk up to Danny Mojitz's grave, Danny Mojitz was a friend of mine who was killed in 1984 in an ambush on Gesher Kasmia. And his parents usually do not go in the morning. It's just too much for them. They go like later in the afternoon on Memorial Day. So one year I happened to be there at the siren, and there was a soldier standing there, and I asked him if he knew Danny. He said no, he was like born when Danny was killed. And it turned out that the Givati unit that Danny was a part of 20 years ago sent him to be by this grave for the siren, which is an amazing thing. And so I was standing, you know, by Cheryl, sort of at the memorial, and I was talking to Cheryl Mandel. And I said to her, you know, this must be such a difficult day for you. I can't imagine. And then as soon as I said it, I realized, well, that's just a stupid thing to say, because I guess every day is a difficult day. She said, no, actually, this day, in certain ways, is not as difficult as the rest of the year. I said, why? She said, because on this day, you really feel that you're not alone. She said, the whole country stops, and people call. And the entire country, I mean, at 11 o'clock in the morning, I want to suggest to you, by the way, that on Wednesday, at 11 o'clock in the morning here in Israel, a siren will go off. The entire country will stop. I don't know if any of you have ever been in Israel for Memorial Day. If you haven't, you should make it your business to try to get here one year. It's an incredible experience. Anywhere in the country, you could be in the middle of the highway. Cars stop and pull over and get out. You could be standing on King George and Dizengoff, King George and Yafo, one of the busiest intersections in Israel, and everything just stops. It's an amazing thing to see. And there's this moment of pure unity. Everybody puts aside, and people just focus on what we share in common, on what we remember, and who we remember, and who we are pained by. And I've even seen, well, whatever. So we're standing there, and she points to this soldier who's standing by Daniel Mandel's grave. Daniel was her eldest, and no, actually, he wasn't her eldest. And he was killed, I think, 4 years ago, literally on Erev Pesach. Right? Like, they were getting ready for the Seder. It was the day before Erev Pesach, and the Israeli army showed up at her house. He had been killed by a sniper, if I'm not mistaken, outside of Shechem. And the next minute, you know, you're all getting ready for Passover and for Chag and for the Seder, and then the next thing, it's the darkest night of your life. And she, you know, every year before Pesach, we have a memorial for him, and she kind of goes into Pesach with that energy. But she's, on Memorial Day, it's a whole different experience, and she said to me, you know, she points over to the soldier, and she says, you see that soldier standing by Daniel's grave? I said, yeah. She said, well, I don't know who that is, and today, it just doesn't matter. He came because the Israeli army and the Israeli people want me to know that my son is not forgotten. She said, that's amazing. That's amazing. Right? So, on a certain level, that's the power of Kedoshim. And Rabbi Riskin, wrote an article this past Shabbat, which I actually urge you to see. It's worth reading. I imagine it's in the Jerusalem Post still on their website. But he spoke about the story of a friend of mine, the son of a friend of mine, Yosef Goodman. Yosef Goodman's parents, Marvin and Ann, whose Sheva Brachos I was at when I was in high school, made Aliyah to Israel. He was a very successful businessman, came from Houston via New York. She was a girl from Brooklyn. They got married, they came to Israel, and he opened up a pizza store. Okay, classic Aliyah story. Just got to do what he always wanted to do. And he started a football league, and he's really responsible for football in Israel, to be honest. And his son, Yosef, who was kind of a troublemaker in high school, tremendous athlete, joined one of the elite units in the Israeli army, which is so elite that I'm not going to mention it by name because I don't want it on a recording. But they were doing a practice jump, a paratroop jump. And they jumped out of a plane, and they had special experimental parachutes, and his parachute got tangled up with his officer's parachute. Now, you're hurtling down through space. It was a low drop. You only have a second or two to make this decision. It was very clear to him that if they didn't disentangle their parachutes, they were both going to die. But his officer's parachute was still capable of opening. So he pulled out his knife, and he cut the ropes of his parachute so that his officer could live. How do you have the presence of mind to understand what it is that you're doing and to make that decision in a moment? Like, how are you not paralyzed by fear? That's just a mind-boggling question. And, of course, he was killed, and he was given a hero's burial. The eulogies were here in Efrat. He was actually buried literally on the eve of my son's bar mitzvah. So I didn't go to the funeral, but we went to the eulogies and the funeral here in Efrat. And his officer came to memorialize Yosef, and he broke down because he said, like, I shouldn't be here. And the only reason I'm here is because of your son. And the night before, Rabbi Riskin went to Marvin and Ann's house. You know, we were in the middle of getting ready for the bar mitzvah. And, you know, it's like a lot of work, but it's all exciting. Your son's going to be bar mitzvah. You've been preparing for this. And then we get this news that Marvin and Ann lost their son, Yosef. And the whole neighborhood was devastated. Such a mix of emotions, you know. And so Rabbi Riskin went over to Marvin's house. And he said that before leaving, he was there, you know, most of the night, sitting with them for hours. Because, of course, he's known Marvin, you know, before Marvin even knew Ann. And then, you know, they have 9 children. I mean, this goes back a long time. And the last thing that Marvin said to him before Rabbi Riskin said, I don't want you to say in the eulogy tomorrow that this is the price of Aliyah. Do you understand that? Your father and your son has just died in service of the country. That's such a natural thing to say. And he says to Rabbi Riskin, I don't want you to tell people tomorrow in the eulogy that this is the price of Aliyah. So Rabbi Riskin thought it was a little strange, but, you know, that's what a father asks you, that's what you do. And so he didn't mention it. And it took him years to understand what Marvin really meant. Because on a certain level, you know, what does it mean to be kadosh? What does it mean, kadoshim to you? Right? So Rashi says kadoshim to you means have a pushim in arayot. Be separate from licentious behavior. And there are different ways to understand that. Some rabbis understand that the reason that Rashi says that is because the section that immediately precedes the portion of kadoshim is the section all about the arayot, all of the, you know, a person isn't supposed to have relations with his sister or his mother or his mother-in-law, etc. So therefore, kadoshim to you would then be the follow-up to that. And by not doing that, you become holy. But that's very difficult to understand. Because what that means is that holiness is just desisting. So some commentaries understand that what that means is that by distancing yourself from inappropriate behavior, you're ready to fill yourself with the behavior and the ethics and the morality given to us by Hashem, which can make us who we're meant to be, right? We've spoken about in the past on these discussions that that in order to discover unlimitedness, you first have to limit yourself, right? By when a man limits himself to one woman in a marriage, he's basically preparing to be in an unlimited relationship with that one person. If you're not willing to limit yourself to one, then you're with so many that you're not really with any. And therefore, one could suggest that Rashi is saying that Kedoshim to you means, and you shall limit yourself in order to discover unlimitedness. The Ramban, however, takes this a stage further. The Ramban says, you know, imagine you're on a plane, okay? And maybe you're new to Judaism. And maybe you're coming back from a month in yeshiva, or a year in yeshiva, and you got all excited because you learned all the stuff about being Jewish, and you made a decision, you know what, you're going to try to do this Jewish thing, right? So you get on a plane, and you're so excited because you flew halal, and so you don't have to worry, you're going to have kosher food, and you're not sure what to do. Do you make blessings, washing the hands? It all seems so confusing. And then right across the aisle from you sits down a hefty, you know, Jewish man in a black hat and a black coat with the tzitzis hanging out and a beard, you know, my stereotype for the moment, which I know is not real, but we'll use it anyway. And you're thrilled because now all you have to do is watch what this guy does, right? And you'll know what to do as a religious Jew. Great. So sure enough, they bring out the food for dinner and you're not sure what to do. And you see he's like opening it up, right? And then you see that he stops for a second, okay? And then he lifts up his tray and he gets out of his chair and, right, you know, the whole routine, and he disappears. And you're thinking, like, where did he go? And then you suddenly remember the washing of the hands. So he doesn't know the halacha about mazonos rolls, and you, maybe you pass him like a mazonos, so fine. So he gets up and he walks with you back to the, you follow him back, and sure enough, he's washing his hands. So you wash his hands and you see what he does, and you do the same, and you listen to his blessing, and you make the same blessing. And then you come back and you're all excited, you're all ready to eat, but now you're watching him and you realize he's looking for something. So you're trying to think, what's he looking for, what's he looking for? Then you remember, oh yeah, the salt, supposed to put salt on the bread. You find your salt, he finds the salt, he puts the salt on, you put the salt on, you lean over, you hear his blessing, you repeat the blessing, and you're so excited, you're sitting next to a religious Jew, you're behaving, you're trying to enter that world on an El Al, Israel Airlines, unbelievable. And you start to eat, and then you notice out of the corner of your eye that this guy can't find something. And you can't figure out why he can't find something because you thought you were done. But you're watching and all of a sudden you realize that what he can't find is a fork. They forgot to include a fork. And you look at your tray and you realize that you don't have a fork either, right? And then you look across and your mouth pops open. Because this fellow starts to take all the food and just shovel it into his mouth with his hands. And spaghetti's flying everywhere and sauces all over the place and rolls are popping up in the air. And it's horrendous. You can't understand this. It's abominable. So you get off the plane and you go home so upset. How could a person behave like that? And you start to look through all of Jewish tradition and you can't find any halacha that says, thou shalt not eat like a pig. Right? As long as you're making the right blessings, as long as you're doing the right thing, doesn't seem he's done anything wrong, until Nachmanides came along. Says the Ramban, al tiyen naval b'rshut HaTorah. Sometimes you can be a pig within the four amot, within the parameters of halakha, of Jewish tradition. This is a specific injunction that you have to rise above that. It's a very difficult mitzvah. Because how do you define it? It's that indefinable that you need to define. It's the mitzvah that speaks to a person that says you have to listen to your inner voice. Okay? There is no way, halakhically, that Yosef Goodman could have known whether or not he was halakhically obligated, traditionally obligated, to cut that rope. There's no way Yosef Goodman could have studied for that, and there's no way Yosef Goodman could have even known the traditional differences of opinion in such a moment. Because at that moment, it wasn't about what he'd learned, it was about who he was. It was about listening to an inner voice that can never be wrong. That's very hard, to listen to that inner voice, you know? It's like when you're in shul, and someone comes, you know, you come to shul and somebody's sitting in your seat, right? And technically, halachically, you can get into a discussion about whether you can kick him out of your seat. But there's an inner voice that if you're willing to listen to, you know is telling you what the right thing is to do. Do you hear that inner voice? Kedusha is all about learning to hear that inner voice. Which brings us to Emor. Because what's going on in this portion? Right? In this portion, seemingly disconnected topic, the Kohen is not supposed to become tameh. He's not supposed to become impure in contact with death. What is the exception? The exception is for one of his close relatives. Now, that's an interesting question. Why? If a Kohen is supposed to be pure, then he should be pure. What's the difference? It might be more painful for him. if it's that he can't connect or stand by the grave of his father. But the halacha is the halacha, and the joy of the Jewish people and the need to serve properly should rise above that. So in order to understand this, we have to understand what it means to be tameh. What does it mean to be impure? What does it mean to be pure? Why does a kohen, why is he obligated to remain pure? And why then, within that context, could it not only make sense to allow a kohen, but actually to obligate him to become impure for his parents, his blood relatives? So it's interesting. What is Tuma and Tara? Most people mistranslate this. You know, they see that a woman has her menstrual cycle and it says that she's Tumeya, and they translate this as unclean, impure, and it has such a negative connotation. If you think about it, we live in this world, and there is actually an inner struggle that we have. Because on the one hand, we're physical animals, right? We need to eat, we need to sleep. We have our basic needs, right? No matter how holy a person you are, eventually you have to sleep. No matter how holy, even Moshe Rabbeinu, after 40 days in the sun, he had to eat, right? We're animals. And what's really the difference between human beings and animals, right? They used to say the difference is speech, but, you know, many animals communicate with each other, right? Some animals are ascribed to having a certain level of speech, right? So what understanding is that we also have, as a part of who we are, an aspect that rises above the physical, right? Call it the soul, the neshama. It's more than just the physical. The physical body that we're in is not who we are, right? If you lost a part of your physical body, you'd still be the same person. You might be a little more depressed, but you'd still be the same person. And we instinctively know that who we are is not really sort of the physical part of who we are. That's just a vehicle that allows us to do things in this world. So who is that who we are? That's the neshama. That's the part of us that is capable of unlimitedness. Whereas the physical being is limited. It's only so much you can go without sleep. Only so much you can do without eating. The spiritual aspect of who we are is unlimited. And all of that which allows us to tap into unlimitedness, all the things that we're capable of that have no limits, the capacity to give and the capacity to love, right? The instinct to give up of our own needs for another, that's all part of that part of us that reaches out to the ultimate unlimited, to Hashem. And we live with this tension, right? Are we limited beings or are we unlimited beings, right? What is the ultimate reminder that at the end of the day, maybe we're just limited temporary beings? Death. Death seems to suggest that it's over. And Judaism suggests that that's an illusion. Because death isn't over. Death just means that that physical part of you ended, but there's no reason to assume that the essence of who you are ended. It just somehow moves on to whatever it moves on to. Right? So because death carries such a dangerous message, because ultimately if I'm just a physical being, there's no point here today and gone tomorrow. So therefore Judaism takes a tremendous amount of time to focus on death. We don't ignore death. We consider it. We struggle with it. We even immerse ourselves when we need to, in order to come out the other side, the healthier, the better for it. That's why when a Jew sort of encounters death and mourning for a close relative, you sit Shiva. Right? And what's the conclusion of that Shiva? The mourner gets up, and he takes a walk around the block at the end of the Shiva. That's part of the tradition, in order to re-immerse himself in the world. Right? When a woman has a menstrual cycle, or for that matter, when a man has a seminal emission, why is there impurity associated there? Because essentially, that is the loss of potential life. The blood is the breakdown of the uterine wall. That potential for life was lost. And that too has to be taken into account. You can't ignore that. You have to take a moment to appreciate the significance. And what is the end of the process of the, let's say in this example, the woman who becomes Tmeya? She immerses in a mikveh. And the mikveh, water, represents life. Because Judaism believes that ultimately I have to be willing to re-immerse myself in life. And that's the message of the Kohen. The Kohen's service is all about life. The Kohen, in serving in the temple, the fact that a Kohen has to be in a state of simcha and joy, is all because he's ultimately trying to be a vehicle to connect the Jewish people with the source of all life. And therefore the Kohen has to avoid at all costs that contact with death, that illusion, that there is no point, that we are beyond. However, when the loved one of the Kohen passes away, and there are two opinions here. One opinion is that in that instance, right, No human being is capable of stepping beyond that contact with death, of struggling with that temporary nature of this world, and therefore that person cannot be in the temple. That person can't be a vehicle for bringing the Jewish people closer to life. That's one opinion. The other opinion is just the opposite. It says that in that moment, when a person is mourning their father or their loved ones, those people are a reminder, they're a bridge to a certain degree of life itself, because they're part of the process. Your closest relatives are those who really gave you life. They were a part of creating who you were. And therefore, in immersing yourself in their loss, you're actually rediscovering who you really are, and discovering that there is so much more to you than just this physical, temporary world. In either event, that seems to be where these two parshiot link up on one level. And as we go into Memorial Day, Yom HaZikaron, you know, I'll give you maybe just one example. It's an unbelievable story. If you go to the Golani Museum at Samot Golani, and if you've never been there, I urge you to go. It's a powerful place. It's the museum that was set up by one of the elite brigades in Israel's military history, Golani. And one of the stories there that you can see is the story of the Yom Kippur War. I'm sorry, the Six-Day War. When the Israelis finally came to the conclusion that they had to take the Golan Heights. So they had intelligence from the air that there was a certain area, Tel Asaki, which is along the northern approach up to the heights, right? And they had information that that tanks could sort of pass through on a certain route. When they got to the area and the tanks were trying to work their way up, I mean, you have to stand below the Golan Heights to appreciate the enormity of what Golani did, of what these men did in that they took the Golan Heights. It's an unbelievable, it's hard to imagine how a unit could do that. They realized that the lines on the sort of, you know, the aerial recon photos that they thought were passable paths were really sort of terraces that were worked fields. They were impassable to tanks. So the infantry had to continue on their own. And they came under heavy fire from a machine gun position that was pinning them down in a place called Tel Asaki. And they got stuck on the barbed wire. And the men of Golani were being mowed down, sort of unit after unit, piece by piece, until a boy named David Shirazi, who was actually wounded already, threw himself forward on top of the barbed wire and started screaming, "Alai, alai, on me, on me." And the men understood what he wanted, and they were under heavy fire. So literally they used him as an obstacle breaker, and they climbed over him, over the barbed wire, right? And succeeded in getting to the top and taking out the machine gun position. David Shirazi died on that hill, but he is memorialized eternally because the general perception at the end of the Six-Day War was that the situation was so close to call that if not for his sacrifice, Syrian guns might still be sitting on top of the Golan Heights today. And it's the same question. How does a person in such a moment, how is a person able to sacrifice themselves to such a degree to put the greater good of the Jewish people, to carry the Jewish people literally on his shoulders? That's a moment of inner voice. That's a moment of Kedoshim Tiyu. And it's followed up by a Mor al HaKohanim. And if we truly are meant to be a Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, a nation of priests, then maybe this is the year that we'll learn to heed the messages of all those who fell before us and become that Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, that holy nation. Holiness really means being a vehicle for bringing Hashem into the world. And you hear at Son that we should merit such things this year. I want to suggest to you, by the way, if you find you have the time, that this Wednesday at 11 a.m., which is, I believe, 6 p.m. in New York, in Eastern Standard Time, I don't know who else has joined the call, take a moment, try to go online, get an Israeli radio station, you can do this on Arutz Sheva, you can do this on a number of different places, and you will hear the siren going off. And that siren will be going off in Israel, and the entire country of Israel will stop. And take a moment, it's exactly 60 seconds of your day, whatever you're doing, right, as silly as it may seem, and stand for a moment of memorial to remember all those who fell in order that we might have a state of Israel. And then, I guess, as the most paying tribute to those who fell, plan your next trip to Israel and when you're going to come and visit us here. And maybe if you do, we'll get to walk in the old city of Yerushalayim together one day soon. So I wish everybody a meaningful Yom HaZikaron and a magnificent Yom HaAtzmaut. I hope you're all planning on lots of different ways to celebrate Israel's 60th birthday. And I hope part of that should be a tefillah that Israel becomes what it's meant to be, because we're not nearly there yet. We have a lot of work to do. And I wish you all Chag HaAtzmaut Sameach. Any questions before we get off?
Rabbi, is that the better? Isn't it 4 a.m. over here?
Pardon?
4 a.m. in New York.
Wait, isn't 11 a.m. in... Oh, 11 a.m. in Israel is 4 a.m. in New York? Ah, it's backwards.
Yep.
Oh, so you know what you should do then? You should do the one... Thank you for pointing that out. You should do the one on Tuesday night. Tuesday night, we do it at 8 p.m. So 8 p.m. is 1 p.m. on Tuesday for you. That's what you should do.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.